Okay, so what might it mean to be good? I'm going to ask this question in the context of biological control for crop protection in Europe, in particular the use of so-called good bugs or insects to counter bad bugs or pests that nibble, deform and destroy commercial crops, in particular edible crops, the descriptor edible meaning for the humans, not the insects. The management of crop pests has become a lot more difficult for many growers in Britain and Europe in recent years with the arrival of EU regulation, the EU directive, on the sustainable use of pesticides. And this directive requires that member states reduce pesticide use, chemical pesticide use, and support safe and effective alternatives, alternatives such as biological control, whether that be biopesticides, semiochemicals, microbials or invertebrates, such as insects. Despite considerable research on biological controls, the number of such products in Europe remains relatively low, and the uptake by growers also remains relatively low compared with countries such as Australia and the US. This is a warning. Like Gail, I like word plays and puns, so it's going to be a bit of it through here. Hopefully they'll keep you alert now. So policymakers and researchers have been prompted to ask, what are the bugs in the system that are producing these apparent discrepancies between a perceived need on the one hand and supply and demand for these insects on the other? And my research focuses on the practices of working with so-called good bugs, also called good guys or beneficials. These insects are manufactured, as they say, and sold in small packages, such as you can see here, sold to suppliers and growers around the country. Insect mobility, indeed. But my interest is not in goodness as an essentialised quality of an insect, nor as something to be somehow mapped or measured along some sort of axis of worth. I take instead as a starting point some recent work by Anne-Marie Moll and one of her grad students, Frank Hertz, on practices of valuing. In their cases, the practices through which tomatoes are made good. And in identifying what they call a series of registers of valuing, they foreground the work of assessing, appreciating, adapting, improving, practices that they understand as somehow blurring a distinction between separate realms of evaluation, valorization, and valuation. So in other words, things are made good, performed as good. Okay, so over the summer just past, I conducted some ethnographic research in plant nurseries, orchards, and insect research and breeding facilities around Britain. And I interviewed manufacturers, researchers, regulators, growers, agronomists, etc., about insects as biocontrols. And in considering the practices through which insects are made good, I'm going to focus on this commercial nursery here, this commercial herb nursery in Sussex, where I workshadowed a horticultural advisor and then interviewed him alongside the nursery's growing manager. Control is a key word in protected crop production in places such as this, and it was visible in many forms in this glasshouse. Commercial growing in this nursery is about maximising output by accelerating the growth of crops, improving the yields, and importantly, reducing crop losses to pests and disease. So there's a lot of attention given to the optimization of growing conditions for these crops, which as you can see is arranged in these metal trays, these very symmetrical, regularised rows and arrangements of plants. And so there's pipes that you can't see underneath, which carry hot water to heat the air underneath the plants to make it a better environment for plant growth. There's other pipes that carry carbon dioxide to increase the levels to up to 1,000 ppm in order to also, once again, improve the growth rate. There's other black plastic pipes that bring water with fertilizer to and from. There's artificial breezes that get produced by having white pipes suspended from the air there, you can see at the top, and other forms of cultural control that produce artificial movement to improve the taste of the crop. They adjust the wavelength of the light overhead, firstly to promote the growth of plants, but also to hinder the growth of other less wanted living things. Okay, so lots of different forms of control going on in here. It's somewhat reminiscent of a laboratory and even a factory. But as I've suggested, my interest is in another aspect of control that is perhaps less obvious to the eye, or at least the untrained eye. For whilst this glasshouse structure is successful at keeping out inclement weather, trampling feet, and perhaps herbivorous mammals, it still remains somewhat permeable to certain small things. Bugs. These are some of the things that we can't quite see. Amblyseus, thrips, ophidius, aphids, trichogramma, chrysoperla, moths, leaf miners, amongst others. This is how Neil, the advisor that I was workshadowing, referred to the bugs in the glasshouse. He used the Latin names for the biological controls, but common names for the pests. Neil visits this nursery once a fortnight to check on which insects are present, both the good bugs and the bad bugs, and to assess how they're getting on and make recommendations for the growing manager on pest control and pest management. And he spends hours walking up and down aisles alongside the plants, clipboard in hand, looking for bugs. How to make the small and diffuse life within this glasshouse visible? And he uses a range of technologies to make insects visible. So you see, every now and then he'll stop alongside some plants and sweep his hand across the canopy and onto his clipboard here. And then he sort of looks at the particulate matter on the clipboard to see if anything's moving. And if there's nothing there, he just brushes it to the floor. In other places and other crops, he pays more attention to the base of the plant and around the stem rather than the foliage. He's also looking, as you can see here, he's not just looking for insects, but for traces of insects. The thick line of a leaf miner on a thyme leaf, or a yellowed leaf or clusters of yellow spots on a basil leaf. Some of these he'll inspect with his hand lens. One thing I've discovered is that I'm very bad at using a hand lens. Every time I go out with someone, I have to learn, be taught all over again how to use a hand lens. And here's another way in which insects are made visible. Flying insects are made visible with these sticky traps. When spaced sparsely and with only a proportion of their surface, their sticky surface uncovered, they're functioning as a monitoring device. And the cards are to some degree selective in which insects are monitored. Of course, we get to colour here. because the predatory insects, the good bugs, tend to use scent rather than colour. The colours tend to attract mainly the bad bugs. The yellow is apparently suggestive of weak plants, which is why they get attracted to it. And so Neil's also checking these monitoring traps as he moves along to see which winged insects, which bodies are present on these traps. Each encounter with an insect is recorded as a note on his pad, the location of the tray, the crop, the insect pest, whether it's dead or alive, whether it's been parasitized. A note becomes an entry in a database, which contributes to a strange kind of natural history of insect activity within this glasshouse. And in this way, Neil produces a record of insect life in the glasshouse. And I'm now going to present, we heard earlier how popular it is to have insect collections. Well, I've used this trope in what follows. I'm now going to present three of the insects in this collection as a way of talking through the practices and processes through which bugs are made good. And as we'll see, in the glasshouse, the goodness of a bug is not simply its success at controlling a pest, and instead there are many different registers of valuing being worked which intersect and sometimes conflict. So this is our first bug in the collection, Trichogramma, a parasitic wasp. On some of the steel support beams that line the aisles where the rosemary plants are, you can see these strips of these cards hanging. The recessed window in the middle, you see here, is filled with hundreds, actually thousands, of pupae, Neil points to one minuscule speck here with his pencil. It's a hatched wasp, which will parasitise the eggs of some pesky moths in the glasshouse. The pest is seasonal, and the trick of grammar has to be in early to be able to catch the moths. Neil makes this decision, he says, based on historical data, weather, and just being out and about in the countryside. So for this insect to be good at controlling a pest in the glasshouse requires this entomological skill, i.e. ensuring that the insect at the right life stage will become active at the right time, as well as the wasp's skill in seeking out and laying its eggs in the eggs of its prey. As you see down here, this wasp is also known as Tricholine B in the Syngenta product catalogue. And it's known by many other names besides, depending on whose manufacturer's catalogue you're looking at. Each manufacturer has its own naming standard, so BCP Certus tends to use the suffix sure on the end, whereas Syngenta uses the suffix line or lean, which is somehow reminiscent of chemical pesticides. Insects are named and branded as commodities. And this is a really important point, because whereas in the past, these insects, these biocontrols, were predominantly produced by government agencies as a form of public good, more recently, there's an increasing reliance on them being provided through the commercial world. Most insect biocontrols are now manufactured en masse, packaged, stored, delivered, used. To be good, then, requires an insect is not just effective as an agent of pest control, but that it's also commercially effective. A good insect is one that can be bred easily in large numbers, can be packaged, has shelf life, and can produce profit. So, for example, an insect which has no stationary or dormant stage will have a limited shelf life, and so it's commercially useless even if it's a good parasite or a good predator. And as Neil stated, we've rejected a lot of beneficials because they're wonderful in the laboratory, wonderful in the greenhouse, but you can't actually mass produce it and get it from A to B in good enough numbers. But as you'll see, clearly numbers aren't an issue for trichogramma, but getting them from A to B requires a lot of work. So the insects can be easily packaged and stored so that they arrive intact and so they can be released at the right moment. You can see here that these cards are used to dispense them. The card's got to be thick enough so the insect isn't crushed when these cards are stacked. The trichogramma are triggered with cold to make the pupae hatch. The other good that's being performed by this delivery system is an ability to patent, to make a unique product from an insect that might otherwise be generally and even freely available. The insect as a regulatory object intersects this work as well. Manufacturers are, on the one hand, interested in non-native species. These might work well, particularly on imported crops with imported pests, and might represent a unique product in a highly competitive market. But there's a problem here. There's a feeling that these insects, these non-natives, cannot be made good because they cannot be made profitable. The Convention on Biological Diversity requires benefits sharing with the country of origin, and it's felt that registration and testing costs are too high in Britain. The next insect in our collection is this one, Amblyseus, a predatory mite that's used in controlling thrips. So here amongst some tarragon plants, you can see very carefully arranged sachets like this, arranged so that the sachet makes contact with either the edges of the pots or with the foliage of the plants where the plants are more mature. Neil demonstrates this for me. He brushes his hand across a basil plant and watch as the quiver passes through the neighbouring plants and then the next row of neighbouring plants. As the plants mature, one bench of pots here will get reorganised as 2.5 benches of pots to make more space for plant growth. And so these sachets must be rearranged and adjusted as the plants are rearranged. So goodness in the form of insect mobility is performed through management of the crop. The sachets perform another good. storage and extension of shelf life. There are some insect predators like Macrolophus that are quite famous for when they run out of their prey, they'll actually turn and eat the crop itself, which obviously is not a very desirable thing. Amblyseus, thankfully, is not quite so treacherous. These sachets here contain a bran mix, so if the mites within these sachets can't find any thrips to feed on, then they can just live on the bran until the prey becomes more populous. Andy, the growing manager, said, years ago, you would have only found Amblyseus products loose, and then obviously for us that's no good, because if you need to put out a lot of Amblyseus, you've got to throw that out day after day. It's very tedious, not very cost effective, and people get bored with it and they don't do a good job. A good insect can survive storage and will not turn on the crop, and if the pest population or the human operator doesn't behave as expected, it makes do. These biocontrols also live in the shadow of chemical pesticides. Amblyseus is quite a specialist when it comes to insect prey, or in Neil's words, they all have their own favourite meat diet. So this species deals with thrips, others eat spider mites. Many of the big name old school chemical pesticides have operated as generalists. So for example, the synthetic pyrethroids, the nicotines and the neonicotinoids. So biocontrols are understood to be somehow more knowledge intensive. The grower must correctly identify each pest. They've got to understand its life cycle. They've got to be able to match that life cycle to the life cycle of a biocontrol. They've got to understand how that biocontrol will survive in the greenhouse, how different biocontrols will interact, and so on. So what's interesting is that suppliers are not just supplying pest control products, but also advisors, people like Neil, as part of a service to growers. And this is what it's felt that it takes to make bugs good. Another side effect of this specialism of the biocontrols is that new pests are becoming visible, because previously the sort of broad sweeping impact of these generalist pesticides would knock everything out. And now that you have to use a specialist biocontrol for each individual pest, you see the rise of things such as leaf hoppers, which aren't getting indiscriminately wiped out as they were with pesticides. To the third and final insect in the collection, Chrysoperla carniae. I think really that scientific name says it all. Pearl of an insect, an efficient predator in its larval stage. So in Bay 18, Section Q, Neil draws my attention to some buckwheat husks, tiny, sort of dark brown, not easily visible amongst the soil. These are carriers for Chrysoperla, the predatory lacewing you can see here. The advantage is that the husks will go unnoticed by the customer who buys the plant. And Neil talks about how there's some biocontrols they like to use, like Ophidius, but the problem is that they leave behind mummy cases, and these are classed as a foreign body. And so that's why sometimes they use Chrysoperla rather than Ophidius, because it won't leave that insect trace. Part of the job in cleaning up the herbs before they get dispatched is getting rid of the evidence of such proliferation of life. So removing leaves that have been munched or removing these mummies. Neil says, no customer has ever complained, but I don't think there's such a thing as a vegetarian. A good insect, perhaps, is one the customer never suspects. So as he's moving along the row, sweeping his plants, Neil finds one of these lacewings and brings it over to show it to me. And he says that lacewings are much more efficient amongst mature plants than flying parasites are, such as the wasp that we saw earlier, because the wasps can't easily penetrate the dense foliage. So here, when these plants are sort of more mature, it's the walking parasites that are better. And so being good as a biocontrol is about being able to work with the life cycle of the crop as well as the pest. And I'm not thinking life cycle just in terms of the maturity of the plant, but life cycle, a production life cycle as well. Because those jaws that you can see there, whilst they're great for predating on unwanted insect pests, they can be problematic And a good bug is one that doesn't bite people. Not the nursery staff, and not the customers who buy the herbs. And so in this nursery, they've changed the way in which they use crassiperla over the years, adapting the timing to reduce the chances of live predators in the orders that they dispatch. Andy, the growing manager, explained, "For me, I need an insect that when it gets here, it's hungry, and it's going to roam around and get on with the job, and it's cost-effective for the numbers per square metre I put out. Now, crassiperla is a very good eater, but it's not the best roamer. It's a lazy bugger, it really is. And so you have to put out probably more per square metre than you would like to, considering how much it can eat." Well, if goodness is maybe an ability to get along with others, this is also true of an ability to coexist with chemicals. So tracer is a chemical naturally derived from bacteria. It contains an active ingredient called spinosad, which is a translaminar spray, which is really good for dealing with things such as leaf miners, for which there aren't yet effective biocontrols. Spinosad is perfectly safe to the predatory beneficials, such as crassiperla, but it's extremely harmful to parasitoid beneficials, says Neil. So for that period when tracer has to be sprayed to control leaf miners, then this is when he asks Andy to cancel his order for the trichogramma wasps and to up his order of crassiperla to increase the level of the predatory lace wings to control the aphids. Okay, to conclude. I've pointed to a series of practices of valuing, of making goodness, that cut across a range of registers. Pest control, monetary, technological, health and safety, aesthetic, naturalness, administrative, and ecological risk. What is good in relation to these concerns varies from situation to situation. The different kinds of goodness here do not very easily always combine, and sometimes they pull in different directions. As John Law and Anne-Marie Mole remind us, such goodnesses are not settled, but are contested. They're made alongside and through realities. I am, however, a little wary of using this turn of phrase, registers of valuing, as an ordering device to describe all this activity that's going on in the glasshouse, as it's still somewhat suggestive of all the things that people do. But making good, as we've seen, also involves the things that insects do, that cards do, that brand do, that chemicals do, and so on. And I want to find a way of talking about these other goings-on that don't render insects and other non-humans as things that are simply somehow operated on or manipulated. And I'm thus reminded of the project that Marianne Leon and her collaborators have posed to themselves this year in perhaps rethinking domestication as in a way that might decenter the human as the primary agent. And my final point is this, though. If goodness is not an essentialised, universalised quality of a bug, it's perhaps equally important to unpack for whom and for what goodnesses are being performed for. Thank you.
Thank you, Steph. That was great. A pestopedia, if I dare. Sorry.